Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and my guest on the show is author Michael Casenow. He is the author of the new novel, The Last Paradise. Michael is a novelist, poet, and scientist, and is currently a geology professor at Eastern Michigan University, where he teaches environmental science courses mainly in geology and hydrogeology. He is also an international selling author of 14 environmental science books emphasizing groundwater quantity. These are all published by Water Resource Publications. He lives in Michigan, where he enjoys watching his son grow. Michael has traveled extensively and lived in many places among a variety of unique personalities. His lifetime resume includes cab driver, busboy, waiter, bartender, lumberman, construction worker, janitor, butcher, and ranch hand in New Mexico, and all of these experiences add a level of authenticity to his written work. So with that said, welcome to the program, Michael.
Well, thank you, Juanita. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. Well, thank you for being here and taking time out of your day. Well, I want to congratulate you. This is your first novel that you've published.
Yes, it is.
So tell us how a geology professor and an author of environmental science books turns into a historical fiction novelist.
Well, first of all, I like writing. I've been writing for a long time, and I basically began to write poetry a long, long time ago in my youth. And so I've always been interested in the written word, the jingle jangle of words, the sound that they make. So I really like that. And as a environmental geologist, I teach about storms and hurricanes and that type of stuff. And I first came upon the Great Galveston Hurricane of 1900 in the classroom, and I taught it. And the more I learned about it, the more it intrigued me. 8,000 people died in that storm. 20,000 people were homeless. 4,000 buildings were knocked down. It basically changed U.S. history because at the time, Galveston was considered to be the third richest city in the country behind New York and Chicago. And everybody who was anybody wanted to move there. And after the storm, it just decimated it, and Galveston never was the same city. So I taught it in the classroom. And the more I learned about it, again, the more I was intrigued. And then I began to read about it. But the stuff that I read about it was in regard to the middle class and the upper class, and yet it was the poor class that were more decimated, hurt by the storm. So I just continued to research it. And I was going to write a novel about the storm itself. But then what happened is that it became a book about the poor and how they survived in the time of Jim Crow, and the hurricane itself became a metaphor, and that's basically how it happened.
So, what was it about the research and the poor at that time that really intrigued you? I mean, like you say, we typically do not hear that side of the story.
Well, what intrigued me the most, I guess, is that when I first began my research, the first books I read, they came out in 1900. And what I read about at that point in time was that the African-American was blamed for a lot of what had happened at the time in Galveston in regard to people stealing and looting and that type. But the more that I learned about what was really going on, it just sort of told me that a story had to be told in regard to some realism about what actually happened, what was going on at the time. So I just decided to write a story about people and how they survived in a time in our history that isn't one that we like to brag about, but one that we shouldn't forget.
Mm-hmm. And I know from what I understand, you've always had an interest in American history dating back that far.
Yeah, I have. I think that from what I'm gathering from my students, it's something that a lot of people don't have a good idea about. Yeah. Most people don't realize that the United States was founded on slavery, indentured servants and slaves. I mean, the economy of the United States was built on that. In 1860, there were 4 million slaves in the country, and there were more slaves in some states than there were people. And this was done basically because for up until about 1910, the cotton industry was the backbone of our industry. And so it was basically just a cheap way to make money. And so the idea of history, at least not forgetting it, but remembering it, is important, at least to me. And when you think about what happened from 1877 up to 1964 with the Jim Crow era, it's a bit insidious. And it's simply something that just intrigues me because that's when our country matured.
Right. And it wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't. I mean, it's interesting to think that in 1964, when President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Bill, before that, there were still drinking fountains in many southern cities that said, you know, blacks here and whites drink here. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was. And I was 14 at the time. And never even considered that was happening elsewhere. And I don't want to condemn the South because the North had its way of segregating people. It was just done a little bit, you know, more secretly.
Why was it called the Jim Crow era? I don't, you know, I think we've heard that term a lot, but do you have an idea specifically why it was called Jim
Crow?
Well,
Jim Crow was a minstrel character. If you've seen any of the 1930 films of how African Americans were depicted, they really came out of that depiction, that personality, that distortion came out of a black minstrel who sang and danced and did, quite frankly, stupid things, buffoonery things, mm-hmm. And that minstrel was called Jim Crow, and so that's where the idea of so you know that was a blemish that was easy to utilize.
Mm-hmm. So, with Galveston, what is the imprint of what happened there back in the 1900s? What's happening now with that city?
Oh well, it's Galveston's gone through an incredible history from 1900 to. I actually lived in Houston for a couple of years,
okay.
And I went to Galveston a couple of times in the 1970s, as you talked about earlier. I did hitchhike around the country and did various
things. Oh, you were hitchhiking. Okay, I was wondering how you got around so much.
And at that time, Galveston was, in the 1970s, early 1970s, it was sort of a down-and-out place, a little bit druggy and that type of stuff. And I never understood why it was a city in which people wrote songs about and you know it had this romantic aura about it. And until later on, I started to investigate the hurricane. And so from 1900 to about 1970, it was still going through those years of trying to adjust to the hurricane damage and losing its prestige. But from the 1970s to today, it's a booming town. It's they've actually made it into a wonderful resort area, and it's a great place for people to live. And it again is a very rich place. Most people who work on Galveston can't live in Galveston because of the income that it takes to live there.
Mm-hmm. Very high cost of living. So back at around the time of the hurricane, what was the population of African American there?
Oh, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
There was 36,000 people, mm-hmm. And I'm going to just guess about, I would imagine, a quarter of the city.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because a lot of the, because it was such a booming industry, city, unemployment was you couldn't find a job in Galveston. It was pretty easy. The black population and the poor white population were pretty much utilized by industry as it is today.
Mm-hmm. So tell me what kind of research you did. Obviously, you had quite a bit of information before you went into this book, but what did you do by the way of research?
Well, again, I just started doing a going to bookstores, going to Amazon, plugging in some letters and trying to figure out some things about Galveston. And so what I picked up was a lot of the books that were first written after the hurricane. A lot of these are redundant, and a lot of them do have their prejudices involved with them. But after that, I did find a really nice book that was written in 1959 by an author by the name of John Edward Weems called A Weekend in September, which talks about that hurricane but does it in realistic and unprejudiced ways. And it's probably one of the best books out there in regard to that. Isaac Storm, about the weatherman, who meteorologist who worked on the island at the time, is also a good book about the storm. And then there's a couple of authors, Patricia Bixel and Elizabeth Turner. They wrote a book called Galveston in the 1900 Storm. It's a relatively new book. It's excellent. And then Ellen Beasley wrote a really, she's a historic preservationist. She wrote a nice book called The Alleys and Back Buildings of Galveston. And my book actually takes place in the Galveston alleys where the poor people lived. Mm-hmm. So there's an incredible amount of information. And then you can just Google. And you can, just by Googling, you can find out, you can confirm bits and pieces of information.
Mm-hmm. Well, so on a personal level, why was it important for you to really, with your characters in this book, to really showcase that poor population?
Don't know. I've been asked that before.
It's interesting.
And I just don't really know. I was raised in a poor family, so I understand that as much as most people do.
Mm-hmm.
But it just it's more about the people trying to figure out how to get into the American dream, mm-hmm. and people who are being left behind in the American dream. And the book is read on various levels, and one of it is also about independence. You know, what it means to be an independent independent person. So I just basically utilize the poor people to get my message across. Also, I've been a bartender, cab driver, and done that type of stuff. I knew these people in my past, and I understood how they reacted to certain situations and the humor that they have. And it's a powerful humor because it's one way that they that they survive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're good people. And that's what's, so just because they're poor doesn't mean they're not good people.
Sure.
And they have a great sense of humor. And it just seems to be something that I think a lot of people don't know. I mean, many people don't hang out with a lot of poor people. And when you do, you find out that they're just like you or I. They just don't have money.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, with the violence that went on back in the day, I know in your research you really did uncover a lot of really disturbing stuff. Some of it you include in this book. How difficult was that for you to grasp when you were going through the whole research and writing process?
Well, I'm a realist, and I've known for a long time, if you understand human history, I mean, for the last 6,000 years, we've been really good at killing each other. And so that type of thing nothing really shocked
mm-hmm.
me too much, though still things do. One of the things that still sticks in my mind, and I'm not asking people to do this, but if you really want to see disturbing things on the web, one of the things I did, I just typed into Google and I typed in "this nigger voted." I did that, and I hit on image, and you just won't believe the stuff that comes up. I mean,
yeah.
there are African Americans who are hanging from trees. There are people sitting around laughing at these, pointing fingers at the dead people. And I mean, some of these were printed in Life magazine and other major magazines, and I was just startled that the human beings would actually act like that, or at least want to be pictured like that. I mean, almost as if they were proud to be there. From 1882 to about 1930, 2,500 blacks were lynched in about 10 southern states. And, I mean, some people might say, well, that's not a great deal. You didn't need to have a lot of them. All you needed to do was one or two, and that sent a message out. Before that, during the time of slaves, if a slave ran away and was caught, they would brand one cheek with an R for runaway. Caught twice, you'd have two R's on your cheeks. Third time, the males were castrated in the open so that the screams could be heard. And that would send a message out also. There was one slave owner who, when he wanted to punish his slaves, would actually have a big barrel, and he put nails in the barrel and knocked them through, and would put a slave in the barrel and then roll it down the hill. I mean, there are just so many things that went on that we're not aware of that, I mean, it's enough to make you pause.
Yeah, it really is an amazing, it's amazing to think that a human being can do that to another human being. And, you know, really that wasn't that long ago. Where do you think we are today in regards to racial equality and what happened 60, 70 years ago?
Well, we have an African-American president, so that's
I mean, isn't that amazing, yeah?
It is amazing. I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, when I began to write the book, he was running for office, and I think he was 30 points behind in Iowa, and I just thought, well, good luck.
Yeah, right.
But he won.
Not
going to
happen.
it just amazed me. We've come a long ways, but it doesn't mean that there's not a long ways to go. I mean, I still will bump into people who will, you know, use the N-word a lot, and we'll still have their prejudices about the Jewish population and other minorities. So it has improved, and I can tell you as a college professor, and I've been doing this for 20 years, that in today's college classroom, the young people, they don't, you know, I pull a lot of students into groups. They don't think like students thought maybe 20 years ago, where blacks and whites will work together in the same group, and it's as if, you know, that this is normal. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't normal 20 years ago. It wasn't, I mean, there were some colleges that they couldn't get into. So in the college classroom, I have certainly seen it improve, and, you know, we've come a long ways, but there's certainly a long, you know, some more strides to make.
A long ways to go. And I imagine in different segments of the country, that's going to be more prevalent as well.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to beat down the South because, you know, Detroit had its riots,
mm-hmm.
Boston had its riots, and so
mm-hmm.
did Philadelphia. But, you know, there are still some places that, you know, it's more improvement needs to be made.
It's you know, I read somewhere, either on your website or somewhere, and it was a quote that you'd made, and something to the fact of inheritance of hate, and it's passed down from generation to generation. So it takes a long time, I imagine, for that to kind of weed itself out.
Yeah, well, hate is not, you know, you're not born with it.
Right.
And you know, it's taught. I mean, it's taught more than anything else, you know, that, I remember growing up, and I remember people in my family telling me, you know, don't touch a black person on a hot day because what'll happen is that your skin will become dark. You know?
Oh, my gosh.
And there are other things that you hear over time.
Sure.
So, it's the thing about hate. The thing about people, it's not what we know that's a problem. It's what we think we know. That's always been the problem in our life. And what we think we know is usually just rumor and innuendo and stuff that doesn't make any sense at all. So in order for this inheritance of hate to stop, you just have to begin to, you know, put people in the same neighborhoods and work in the same factories and go to the same schools. And that's what has happened. Someone once asked me what I think has really improved upon the tolerance in this country. And although I find television to be a bit odd at times, when you think about all the commercials and how they mix and match different ethnic groups and different minorities, we're used to seeing that.
Mm.
And that's what it comes down to. If you're just used to it, and if you live within with those people and talk to those people, so any type of group, you're going to find out that they're just like you. They're just trying to stay alive.
Right. Good point. That's such a good point. Well, let's talk a little about The Last Paradise, the book, And your characters, Maxwell and Newt. So tell us a little bit about these people.
Well, first of all, you're probably going to ask me where these people came from, and I don't know.
You don't know? They're not friends of yours, or
no.
They're not you put in to the
book? There's always bits and pieces of any writer in a book.
Yes.
Maxwell is a person whose background we don't really know, but clues are given to us throughout the book. He was probably a hired killer in his youth, and he has basically gone through some sort of an epiphany and has decided to live out his life and maybe not do good things but not do bad things. He lives outside the law. But not moral laws. He lives outside of cultural laws and political laws. He basically has learned at his age to just do the right thing. Mm-hmm. He's gotten to the point in his life where he's sort of a kind man, but you don't want to mess with him. And as is discovered in the book later on, near the end of the book, is that this is the one person you don't want to provoke. Newt, on the other hand, he went to Harvard for a year. He was married four times. He's an ex-gambler. But he's a little bit more intellectual than Maxwell is, and he's as fast as he can get himself into trouble, he can get himself out of trouble. So you have these two drifters moving out, and they become very good friends as they go through the book. And then there's Fanny Brown, who is the prostitute, mm-hmm. who Maxwell has a relationship with. And she's contrasted against Jenny Connor, another person who Maxwell had a relationship with a long time ago. But Jenny's a very beautiful woman who has actually sold her beauty for wealth. So what we have here really is a contrast between a lower-class prostitute and a upper-class individual who used her beauty in a different sort of way. But what we find near the end of the book is that Fanny is a much better person and somebody that you would probably prefer to spend your life with. The Bishop family, that's the African-American family. And one of the things that I did not want to do, and I think that some authors have made mistakes, is that when they start talking about African-Americans at that time of the century, they tend to use a eugenics type of language, if that's what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And, I wanted my people to be people. I wanted them to talk like, normal Americans talk and say good things and be happy and have a loving time and not be this 1930, 1940 stereotype of the people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I made them as just like you or I. And actually, opposed to Newt and Maxwell, they have dreams of their children going to college. So those are the main characters, and then we have other characters in the book like Captain Scurvy and Fearless Frank and Bleach, the albino bartender, and they all hang out at this one place, and they're all people who have a past, and some of their past may be a little bit more dangerous than others, but they're good people. They're just trying to get through a rough time in history in one of the richest places that our country had ever seen.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Michael Castanel. He is the author of The Last Paradise, and you can find out more through Michael's website, michaelcastanel.com. And so really, it's the characters that make this book then relatable to a modern audience.
Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, when I began to write the book, I didn't know where it was going to go, and then these characters just popped into my head, and they worked out very well. Yeah, it's a character-driven book. It's when I write, one of the things I don't want to do is preach. I just don't like preachy books. I mean, you know, I can make my own decisions, and so I didn't want to write a book like that. But I like, you know, I think a good reader simply doesn't want that either.
Sure. No, of course not.
And they want to, you know, but the story has to be, you know, if you want to talk about stuff, if you want to muse about ideas, stories have to be, the story has to be it. It has to be what the book's about. The reader has to have a reason to turn the page. And the only way that a reader is going to turn a page if they care about the characters. They have to become a stakeholder in the characters. And that's how I tried to write the book.
Mm-hmm. So where did The Last Paradise come from? What's the title representative of?
Well, the hurricane became a metaphor for the future. And what could happen if we aren't tolerant, if we don't, if we were not vigilant in regard to democracy. The last paradise, as I've told other people, is really about the only paradise, and that's the democracy that we have invented in regard to our country. The Greeks tried it, but they didn't do a very good job with it, but we have. And just like the island of Galveston, democracy is built on solid ground, but you know, it can be sand. It can be a sandbar. And if you aren't tolerant, if you aren't vigilant, if you don't protect yourself from the people who are trying to take advantage of you, that democracy can erode away very, very fast. And so The Last Paradise is really an idea about our country being the only paradise, in essence. It's the last paradise. It's the only paradise. And by golly, we better protect it, and we better understand the history of it, and we better understand the people who are around us and the people who we elect. So, the storm itself is a metaphor for the future, and Galveston, being very wealthy as our country is a metaphor for our times today.
Well, how do some of the themes? I mean, you go into the whole idea of greed, power, corruption, these types of themes in this book. How are you seeing a connection with what's going on today? I mean, what's happened with Wall Street? What just the things that are happening on our planet, environmentally, politically?
Well, yeah, what's happening today in the country? I mean, this question has been asked more than once, and
sure.
It's really interesting. When I wrote the book, I mean, sometimes you just happen to be at the right place at the right time. And I wrote the book because I thought it was a good story there. And then, you know,
it's deeper than that.
What's that?
It's much deeper than that.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is. And I gave it to a friend, and my friend read it and came back to me and said, "Wow, this is about today." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yeah, but I didn't mean for it to be about today." And so, but we talked about it, and it was fairly clear that the storm that we're going through today, this economic storm that we're going through today, the environmental problems that we're having today, all of these things, they do work back to 1900. If you think about the island as that those times of being a metaphor for today, I mean, the storm that we're going through today in regard to the banking industry and the unemployment and the big pop in the housing bubble, all of these things, you know, these are also hurricanes, but you know, they're a different type, and they're still destructive. They ruin families. I mean, people kill themselves over these things.
Yeah.
And it does have a good link in regard to what's happening today.
Mhm. Mhm. So, as a history buff, how do you think we will look back 50 to 100 years, in the future, looking back today and seeing what's happening? How do you think we'll perceive all of this?
Well, it depends upon where we go. I don't know.
Predictions.
Yeah, I don't know where we're going to be going. I don't know. You know, I think the Obama administration is doing a good job now, but, you know, who knows what they're going to be doing in 2 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do a good job, I think we'll look back upon this time as a time in which, again, the country turned another corner. I mean, you can go through various times. I mean, 1929 was a time that we turned a corner because we had to. 1941 was a time we turned a corner because we had to. And then in 1964 or the 1960s, we turned a corner. The country does, and we will, the country will heal itself in regard to the economic problems because we always have. The great things about Americans is that we do pick ourselves up, we dust ourselves off, we take a deep breath, and we say, let's go. I think we will look back at this as a very positive time in American history. But I think, like any great country, we're still going to have our problems. And even though we'll say, well, we made some great strides, I think we're always going to have to say, yeah, but we've got to be vigilant. We've got to be tolerant. We have to respect the person next to us.
Good point. So we go forward with our eyes wide open.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
good.
Why did you decide to actually write this book about the Galveston hurricane as opposed to maybe a hurricane more modern like the Hurricane Katrina?
Because this hurricane was devastating. This was absolutely incredible. This when I began to read about what these people went through, it's just amazing. For whatever reason, if I've got my facts straight, the hurricane flag wasn't lifted on the Weather Bureau until the hurricane was on the island.
Oh, my God.
Don't ask me why that occurred. But, again, 8,000 people died. You had...
They didn't have the instruments back then or anything, did they?
No, but...
Forewarning.
But the Cubans, they knew what was going on. And the Cubans tended to... They warned the United States, but the problem was that the Cubans were Latinos. And, of course, we couldn't listen to Latinos telling us what to do.
Oh.
I mean, the Cubans were, they knew, I mean, they've been through tropical storms and hurricanes forever. And, you know, they could use animals to tell you if something bad was happening in regard to atmospheric pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So we tended to just sort of put them off and really didn't listen to what they were telling us in the warnings. Now, when the hurricane, we don't know what category it was, but it was probably a class 4. And when the hurricane hit the island, again, it destroyed 4,000 buildings, killed 8,000 people, mm-hmm. left 20,000 homeless. And so now what you had in a subtropical area, you had 8,000 dead bodies.
Mm-hmm.
What were you going to do with these dead bodies? Well, they figured that what they were going to do with these bodies is they were going to put them on a barge and they were going to dump them out at sea.
Really?
That's what they did. So they tried it the first time. They put 700 bodies out to sea. They dumped them into the ocean, and then the next day the tide brought them back in.
They washed on shore, of course.
Yes. So now what you have is that you've got 8,000 bodies that you can't dump at sea. So what do you do?
Uh-huh.
Well, what they decided to do was build funeral pyres. And they built them all around the island, and they stacked the bodies like cordwood, and they poured oil on them, and they lit the bodies. And what no one knew was that there were so many bodies to burn that they were going to burn, the funeral pyres would burn up until November. This was incredible. Now, you think of this for a moment, and this is really an incredibly sad thought. You go out the next day, it's a sunny, hot day, and you're looking for your mother or your wife or your kids or somebody you love, and you go to these funeral pyres where the bodies are just stacked up. And the people who are in charge of burning the bodies say, yeah, you can go through that pile there, take a look.
Oh, my gosh.
And then you're going through that pile, and you're turning over body after body. These bodies they're bloated. The stink was incredible, and if you were unlucky enough to, or come to a closure, I guess, if that's lucky, you'd be able to find the person that you were looking for. And then what was happening on the island also is that, and this happens, which is just about every disaster anyways, there were people coming on the island, and they were there to loot dead bodies. And a lot of they would be walking around with wire cutters. And I don't mean to gross you out.
Yeah.
But what they were doing is that because the bodies had bloated up so much that they couldn't get the rings off fingers, so they would cut the fingers. They would put them in bags. And they would also cut the ears off of women, too, who had earrings on them.
Oh, my gosh.
And then apparently what they would do later on is, boil them and get the jewelry off. But within, you asked the question, so I'm telling you why I was intrigued.
No, it's fascinating.
And so what happened is that as soon as that was going on, it was shoot to kill by the militia.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody was by a body with a pair of cutters, I mean, they just shot them. That's how they ended that. So there were all of these remarkable things happening on the island that we just
we never hear about this stuff.
Never hear
mm-hmm.
about it, and we've never lived through it.
Mm-hmm.
And these people did.
Yeah.
And you just got to give them credit.
Didn't that hurricane hit in the middle of the night as well?
Yeah, it did too. And that's another thing that well, I mean, there was electricity there, but it wasn't anything like it is today.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you need to understand also is that the North Bay came down towards Galveston, came across the island, and the surge was going from the southeast up into the island. So the island itself was actually at one point beneath water. It was on the ocean bottom. I mean, the island wasn't there except for the building sticking out.
Oh, my God.
And so there were just lots of people walking around on the island. You couldn't see anybody unless the lightning went out. But what you could do is you could hear the scream. And with the 160, 170 mile per hour winds that were going on the island, many people were simply killed by the blowing debris.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that happened in the 1890s is that Galveston had suffered a great fire. And after that great fire, they decided to put slate on the roofs so that the fires wouldn't go from roof to roof. And they, during the Great Galveston Fire, they lost, 40 city blocks, something like that.
Yeah, a huge
so
amount.
They put the slate on the roofs. So what happened is that that would certainly help the fires. But now you've got this 160 mile per hour wind blowing, taking the shale off the roof, and so what you've got are these guillotine-like frisbees going through the air, just hitting people. And that, too, caused a lot of deaths.
Oh, that's devastating. So when they rebuilt, they probably rethought that idea?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what they did. I do know that they eventually built a seawall.
Mm-hmm.
For the longest time, they didn't want to have a seawall. I'm not sure why. But after the hurricane, before the hurricane, the island was about 8 feet above sea level at its highest point, about that. And after that, what they did is I think they added 7 more feet throughout the whole island by dredging sand from the ocean and pushing it on the island. And then they built a great big seawall, which did help with the last hurricane that they had.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't help out a lot, but it was better than what would have had happened.
So do you think that there's a possibility of that kind of destruction happening today?
Well, it did occur in Katrina.
Sure.
I mean,
a little different, though.
A little bit different, but the analogy is pretty good. Both of them had a water body to the north. Galveston has the North Bay. Katrina has Lake Pontchartrain. And then, of course, both of them have the Gulf to the south. And what happens is that both of these bodies, the northern bodies and the southern bodies, they just came together and they just flooded. So, it certainly could happen. And the good news about Galveston is that with the last hurricane, the bureaucracy out there, they actually announced that if you stay on the island, there'll be imminent death. So
I remember that report.
They understood the history.
Yeah.
And so that got people off the island fairly quickly. And if they wouldn't have done that, there would have been imminent death.
Yeah.
So, nature, there's always a bigger wind. There's always a bigger flood. There's always a bigger storm. And, we are just at the mercy of nature.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess with the technology we have now, we can foresee, days ahead of time.
Yeah, that's the one thing that we can do.
We can
make a prediction. We can see where it's coming. We can say the hurricane may veer left, may veer right, but, you need to get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the good news that what we can do. And with Katrina, we just, for whatever reasons, a lot of the poor people were left behind. And I think that lesson has been learned, is that we need to get everybody out. Regardless
what a tough lesson, though.
What's that? An absolutely tough lesson. But the neat thing about today's media is that even though they do a lot of goofy things, boy, they put the truth out there.
There isn't a level of accountability.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And the films don't lie.
Yeah. Yeah, we're in this era of everything you can find on the internet. YouTube changed everything,
yeah.
And so Yeah, absolutely. So interesting. So you are a hydrogeologist. I'm
yes,
interested to find out what exactly that is, and if all of your books, I'm sure you're going to be writing more novels, if they're all going to have kind of a water theme to them.
Well, what's interesting is that two of them do. I'm writing a ghost story right now, and that does have a water. It takes place up in New Brunswick. But I just tend to like coastal areas. Again, as an environmental geologist, a hydrogeologist, I understand the coast pretty well. So it's pretty easy for me to write about that and the beauty of it and what it means. So I guess, you know, my books will always take people to some place. I think that's a good thing to do. As a reader, I want to be taken to some place like New Orleans or Galveston or Paris or New Brunswick or some place that I haven't been and sort of enjoy that. Water doesn't have to be a theme in my books, but when it is, I pretty much know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely, and you probably really find a lot of joy in writing about that.
Yeah, I do. Somebody once asked me about my job, and I said it's a kick job. I mean, what I do is I do research. And then I go in and I have a bunch of people who have to listen to me talk about what I do. And, you know,
so
it's a great thing. And, I do enjoy writing about it. To digress a little bit here in regard to what I study, you know, wetlands and lakes and rivers and groundwater. And the new crisis that, you know, you're in Texas, so you probably know this better than most people east of the Mississippi. But the water crisis is going to come to a head really soon.
Oh yeah, aquifers are drying up.
They're drying up the Ogallala Aquifer, which starts in northern Texas and goes north up into South Dakota, I think it is.
Huge aquifer,
but best case scenario, that it's going to get down to its salty zone. Best case scenario by 2020. Worst case scenario 2050.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
and,
good. I didn't know.
There was a report out recently. I forgot who put it out, but there was a report put out recently that 35 states in the next 5 years will have water shortages. So this fresh water idea, it's a problem that nobody's talking about, and yet it's real. I've already told my students, see, one day you're going to wake up like I did one day. And gasoline went up to $2 a gallon. Your water bill is going to be enormous because it just isn't going to be there.
Yeah. How do you think we should prepare for that?
Oh, well, conservation is for one thing. Just respect it. Respect the resource more than anything else. The problem that we have is that we spoil ourselves. And, you know, we're just sort of used to leaving that tap on or watering our lawns and doing things with water that most countries just, you know, I mean, in some countries, women actually spend 8 hours a day collecting firewood and water. That's what they do.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
And you know, here we just expect it to happen.
Yeah.
So the idea of conservation and respecting it and being aware that the problem is out there. Right now, the one bad thing that our government does, it just doesn't educate us, because I don't think they're educated in regard to problems. But the water problem is, well, again, you're in Texas, so
it's huge. I'm really, really aware of that, and I'm wondering, definitely on a personal level we all have to conserve, but then there's big business like agriculture and that sort of thing. It's a, you know, it's a multi-layered issue.
Oh, yeah. What's going to happen in the future is that, you know, people are talking about using the shale oil that we have in the northern mountains, and that's a possibility because there's a trillion barrels of shale oil out there. However, it takes 3 barrels of water to make 1 barrel of shale oil, so you've got to have 3 trillion barrels of fresh water. Now you're competing with the ranchers, you're competing with the farmers. Somebody's going to have to make a choice.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm telling my son, you know, these are things you're going to be voting for in the future.
Yeah. Interesting times to come.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So you will be writing, obviously, for quite a long time. This is just book one.
Yes, it is. Again, I'm working on a ghost story. It's a different type of ghost story. And then I'm also working on another novel in regard to a college professor who is resurrected through a nervous breakdown and discovers what's important in life.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it is, and there'll be a lot of some more quirky characters in regard to the college scene and what he goes through and how he discovers that writing books and getting fame and fortune and all that good stuff that we all strive for really isn't important. What's important is the people who are around you, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you take care of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're a people person. This is really coming through in your work.
Well, I have empathy towards people who struggle, good people who struggle. I mean, you know, there's always, you always have, you know, the outlaw people out there. But good people who play by the rules and do good things and just work hard, I think you have to have empathy for that. If you don't, you've got holes in your soul. I mean, you just really have to have a good eye for the people who are trying. And, I worked my way through college, and, you know, I came from a family that was dysfunctional. And, I wasn't born with a silver spoon, so I understand what it means to go through hard times and to pull yourself out of that drudgery. And so it's easy for me to write about it,
mm-hmm.
because I've been there.
There's a strength of character that comes when you've been there.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael, it's been great talking with you.
Talking with you.
What a wonderful time. So your website is michaelcasenow.com. I hope I'm getting your last name pronunciation.
Well, Michael Casenow, whatever works for you.
Casenow. Oh, okay, Michael Casenow. Okay, so there we go, your website. Your book can be purchased through your site?
Right.
Okay, good. And then you've got, I know, all sorts of other information and a little dabbling of your poetry up there. So.
Yeah, there's some poetry there. There's a little bit in regard to chapter one, so you see how I write. There's a couple of e-books you can download. You can download the poetry. You can download an environmental book about groundwater. And then there's some art you can download. Some other questions about your use of water and some posters that you can get. You don't have to buy anything. You can just go to the free gifts and get some really neat stuff. I've had some people say some really nice things about it. So, what I tried to do is just make a website that was easy to get through, not full of clutter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can go to the navigation bar and, you know, what you want to know, you can go right to it.
Yeah, it's a lovely site. You really did a good job on it. So we definitely encourage people to check it out.
Thank you.
Yes, yes. Well, Michael, thank you so much. We will definitely have you back. I know book two will probably be out within the next year.
I'm hoping so. I'm hoping to have it ready for publication next year sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's going through the process right now where I'm just editing, and then I'm going to have to hire a copy editor to do some more editing. So the thing about a book, you really have to be your worst critic, and you also have to make sure that, I mean, even the best writers in the world have to have a copy editor. So I'm doing my best to make sure what I put out there is a good piece of art.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the editing process is crucial. So, yeah, that's right. Well, good luck to you. All the best. I know that you're very busy. If you're promoting book one and you're working on book two, you probably have no free time at all to do anything else. But I just really appreciate you taking your time up today.
Well, thank you so much. This has been fun.
You bet. Take care.
Bye.
All right, listeners, that's been Michael Casenow. His book, The Last Paradise, is out now, and you can find out more about Michael through his website, michaelcasenow.com. So I want to thank you so much for tuning in and listening to our interview today. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.